Comics. Comics. Welcome to ORP, otherwise known as Omen Revelations Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Nunley.
And I'm your co-host, Steve Sellers. On ORP, we like to talk about geek stuff, pop culture, including movies and TV series, as well as comic books and comic characters. But that's not all, is it, Mike?
No, it's not, Steve. We're also writers for Omen Comics and Revelation Comics. So we like to talk about both writing and our comics. So podcast and chill with us. Today we are starting the first episode of Season 4 on ORP, and on this first of a two-part episode, Steve and I are going to talk about the Alien franchise. In this first episode, we'll be talking about Alien, Aliens, and Alien 3. In Part 2, which will come tomorrow, we're going to talk about Alien Resurrection, Prometheus, and Alien Covenant. But before we jump into the first film, what can you tell us about both your experiences as a kid with sci-fi horror and your reactions as a kid to seeing the Alien film, Steve?
I'm probably not the best person to ask that question because I came into Alien late. I was aware of it, and the xenomorph designed by Giger creeped me out as a kid, but I never watched any of the films except for a sum of Alien 3 on cable, which in retrospect was not the best way to get into the series. I just was never really that much of a horror kid back then. I discovered the series properly years later when I started trying to understand the genre. Then I started getting a proper respect for the series with the first two films and for sci-fi horror in general. But I know you were way more into horror at that age. So what was that experience like for you?
I know that for me, while I had seen other sci-fi horror movies as a kid, because they were on reruns and my dad or grandpa would be watching them. So I saw stuff like The Thing from Another World from 1951, Forbidden Planet from 1956, The Fly from 1956, or The Tingler from 1959. That was a weird one. And others like that. But none of them really stuck with me like Alien did. That was a very memorable movie with some shocking scenes in it that stayed with you. I mean, the scene where the facehugger jumps out of that egg onto Kane was super scary and complete with an awesome jump scare. And of course, the chestburster scene was very iconic. Even as a kid, I liked the visceral and gory stuff, and that scene really delivered. But then when Cameron did Aliens, I was a full-fledged fan of the franchise by then. Aliens combined action, sci-fi, and horror in a way that I'd never seen done as well since. In fact, both of those films are still on my all-time favorites list.
They're up for me too now, even if once again we're coming at it from different perspectives. Alien, I think, is the gold standard when it comes to sci-fi horror, and you have to look to films like Event Horizon to find something even close for me. Aliens I love for a very different reason, and we'll talk about the different take that Cameron did with it when we get to that film. But I think of Aliens as the definitive military science fiction film. It takes a Starship Troopers formula and ramps it up to 11. But first, we need to talk about the original Alien film. So why don't we get into exactly why that movie is considered a classic?
Sure. Aliens was directed by the great Ridley Scott and was scripted by Dan O'Bannon, David Giller, and Walter Hill, based on a story by O'Bannon and Ronald Shusett. Just a little bit of trivia. Dan O'Bannon also worked on Dune from 1984, and Ron Shusett worked on what would become Total Recall from 1990. The film stars Tom Skerritt as Captain Dallas, Sigourney Weaver as Warrant Officer Ripley, Veronica Cartwright as Navigator Lambert, Harry Dean Stanton as Engineer Brett, John Hurt and as Executive Officer Kane, Ian Holm as the Android Science Officer Ash, and Yaphet Kotto as Chief Engineer Parker. The very long and slender Nigerian Bolaji Badejo played the alien. Ridley Scott believed that the 6'10" Badejo and his slender frame could portray the alien and look as if his arms and legs were too long to be real, creating the illusion that a human being cannot possibly be inside the costume. But Badejo was not the only one who portrayed the alien in the film. Stuntmen Eddie Powell and Roy Scammell did too in some scenes.
Yeah, this is a really solid cast, and many of them really took off after this movie. Particularly Sigourney Weaver, Tom Skerritt, Harry Dean Stanton, Sir John Hurt, the War Doctor himself, and Ian Holm. One interesting thing that I recently found out about Dan O'Bannon, the writer of the film, he's an old collaborator of John Carpenter's. We'll probably talk more about that later, so I'll let you get into that. Still, given that experience, moving from that to sci-fi horror probably wasn't too difficult for him. And as an aside, I will also say Giler and Hill also worked on Tales of the Crypt, the TV series. But anyway, why don't we get into what happens to the film itself?
Sure, Steve. That sounds fun. I have to say that Brett and Parker complaining about getting equal shares all the time when they signed a contract like everyone else just bugs me, especially in that they clearly didn't even read the contract, as they didn't know about the clause in the contract that says any systemized transmission coming from a possible intelligent origin must be investigated under penalty of total forfeiture of shares. In my opinion, it's a matter of honor and integrity to do what you were paid to do, and clearly Brett and Parker have none of either, as they seem to have planned all along that they were going to essentially go on strike once they were out in space and the company was counting on them to attempt to force the company to pay them more. They actually refused to repair the ship until they got their equal shares at one point. Maybe it's because I'm a business owner and I have friends that own businesses, but that is some low-handed crap right there. They could have just taken another job and let someone else take their engineering positions, but they went in knowing they were scamming their employers.
Yeah, I'll give Brett and Parker this much. Given what a corrupt company that Weyland-Yutani is, I really wouldn't be surprised if they were underpaying their workers too, especially given the risks that they're sending these people on. At the same time, I do agree that Brett and Parker get really annoying when they're constantly complaining about their wages. I mean, to be honest, they're probably complaining to the wrong people anyway. It's probably the contractor at the company who they need to be complaining to, and those people are back on Earth. The rest of the crew are just trying to survive and do their jobs and get back in one piece, just like they are. So they don't deserve the crap they're getting from those two.
I had not considered the corruption of the Weyland-Yutani Corporation in that scenario. I suppose that they could have been underpaid as well. So that does add some, just a little, but some validity to their argument. But my guess is that they still knew what those wages were when they signed the contract. They were guaranteed a share of whatever they found on LV-426, just like everyone else. But you were definitely right about them complaining to the wrong people. I don't think anyone on that ship had any more authority or ability beyond their positions on the mission, including the captain. They couldn't have done anything. But if I could talk about another thing that jumped out at me in the film. As they were walking through the alien ship, I can't help but notice all of the things that Prometheus pulled from Alien throughout the ship, as far as the engineers and the ship itself goes, and I suppose even down to how David ultimately leaves things. For instance, the chamber where the eggs or pods, essentially external wombs, are that they are in is hot. Kane says it's like the goddamn tropics in here. One of the things growing humans and creatures need is heat. They have to be kept warm or they will die. And clearly, while the rest of the ship is dead, this room is being kept heated. And with how it's built, I don't know, it just speaks to me of intent. I think this room has an alternate power source or something that is keeping it hot. And I think that with how perfectly the room houses the cacophony of eggs in that room, it just had to be designed and built for that very purpose.
I hadn't really thought about that point before, but it does make sense. Since the engineers were partly responsible for their creations, then it stands to reason that they'd know what conditions would be required for them to thrive. They'd certainly be able to adjust their life support settings for their creations to grow as needed. Alternatively, it could be that the same environmental settings that the space jockeys used were also appropriate for the xenomorphs. I mean, we've seen at least one of the worlds that the engineers lived on, and that planet had warm and humid conditions suitable for the xenomorph eggs.
I suppose that is possible as well. The one thing that makes me doubt that is that no one complains about the heat in any of the other places on the ship. Granted, that can mean that life support was damaged in all the other areas of the ship, but for it to be that particular room that still works makes me think that it had to have been kept protected in the crash. But either way, I think I'm leaning towards that room in particular needing life support, whether that was the engineers or David.
That could very well be possible, and I could see David doing that. But even if we're considering all these issues, it's pretty clear the characters weren't. In fact, the landing party is taking really poor precautions from the moment they get off the Nostromo.
Oh, they definitely were. As essentially space truckers on the Nostromo, they were not really prepared for a mission of that type. If I had to guess, there was a manual or something, but no real training on how to go about a mission like that and take all of the proper precautions took place. Still, I find it interesting that Dallas, as the captain, seems to be flying by the seat of his pants and just goes with whatever he feels like at the moment. That's a crappy way to do your job, in my opinion, but I might be okay if he at least adhered to the rules and regulations, or even his position on whether or not to follow them. At first, he is compliant with Mother's orders to investigate LV-426 and says that everyone needed to do as they were contracted. So when it's convenient, Dallas says that the company's orders are to be followed. But when he returns to the ship with Kane, who has a facehugger on his head, Dallas demands that especially when his orders violate regulations, they should be followed. When Ripley tells him that she won't let him in because it violates quarantine protocol. Dallas is contradicting himself here, and I don't think he even knows it. Dallas is the captain of the Nostromo and got his authority from the company based on their rules, regulations, and protocols. So for the captain of the ship to insist on ignoring the company's rules, regulations, and protocol, one of the very things that even made him captain, in essence denies his authority as valid if the rules are ignored.
Oh, yeah. Dallas does make some really poor decisions as captain in this film. I mean, because Ripley was completely right about quarantine protocols, which Dallas completely ignores, as you say. I mean, Dallas risks the potential exposure of the entire crew to whatever Kane contracted, and that could have been anything as far as he knew. So honestly, I have to put the destruction of the Nostromo and the loss of all but two survivors down to Dallas for that decision. It was Dallas's responsibility as captain to protect the crew and follow protocol, and his failure to do so doomed the entire ship. But then this goes back to one of my issues with a lot of horror films. The bad stuff happens because the main characters make bad decisions. I mean, Ash might have been an instigator because he was a spy for Weyland Yutani. I totally buy that. But Dallas was in command, and so the consequences for that decision lie on him.
We are 100% agreed there. Ripley did nothing but her job and survive. Dallas blew that situation, and it was exacerbated by Ash, the company spy, as you put it. That really makes Ripley's conversation with the board and aliens that much more frustrating. But that kind of leads into my next point. I think that the company knew full well that the xenomorphs existed and that Ash was their direct agent on board. My guess is this would have been revealed further in Ridley Scott's prequel movies, but I assume that David's research was discovered or even reported. As we find out in Alien 3, all of the Weyland-Yutani ship auto-report everything. But my point remains that I think the company had foreknowledge, and at least part of that is Special Order 937 that prioritized the return of the organism over everything else, including the crew. I don't know about you, but Special Order 937 reminds me of RoboCop's fourth directive, which was classified initially until he attempted to violate it, or Order 66 from Revenge of the Sith. It's like a set of sub-programming that takes over under certain circumstances. In Ash's case, I think the company knew that LV-426 was the last known place that the xenomorphs and or the ship was said to be. And when the systematized transmission came from LV-426, Ash's directive, Special Order 937, kicked in. Consider that it was Ash insisting that the crew go down to LV-426, and it was he who reminded them of the clause in their contract. It seems to me that would be the captain's job, if it was anybody's, to remind them about their contracts. What's more is that it was Ash who let Dallas, Kane, and Lambert back in the ship despite it violating quarantine and a direct order from Ripley. When confronted about this by Ripley, Ash claims that he forgot she was in charge, and I don't believe that for a second. He also tries to claim that he let them in out of concern for Kane, but that wasn't true either. All other priorities rescinded. You'll also notice that when the chestburster came out of Kane, everyone in that room was freaking right the hell out except Ash. He sat there looking at it unfold as if he were expecting that to happen and observing an experiment. Ash even stopped the crew from killing the creature when they could. But those aren't the only scenes that make me feel like he had been taken taken over by Special Order 937. Ash is sweating that white liquid when he goes after Ripley, which makes me wonder if there was not some resistance to the Order now that it has involved him having to take a life himself. Bishop all but says that Asimov's laws of robotics are in place in Aliens, and attacking Ripley would fully violate those laws. In my opinion, Ash had a genuine scientific curiosity and admiration for the xenomorphs, as he called them the perfect organism, a phrase that would be repeated in later movies. But Asimov's three laws were hardwired into the synthetics, even if, in Bishop's words, those old models were a bit twitchy. Ash's orders kind of contradicted themselves there. I think that considering the prequels and Aliens, this theory of the company's foreknowledge is fully supported. But what do you think about all that, Steve?
Yeah, I would agree with all that. And you covered Ash's role in the whole conspiracy pretty well. I have no doubt that Weyland-Yutani deliberately sent the Nostromo out there to die with Ash as their mole aboard the ship. They knew about the alien by that point. I'm sure that they would have sent a ship after the Prometheus, and if so, they likely found whatever reports were left by Peter Weyland, Liz Shaw, and the rest of the crew. They could have gotten a lot of data just off the ship's computers. It's likewise possible they could have found David's research or any number of other things we don't know about either. It's also obvious that Weyland-Yutani was in full cover-up mode when Ripley returned to Earth and gave a report about the Nostromo. There is a lot of incidental evidence all throughout the films that Weyland-Yutani knew a lot more than they were saying, and they were probably responsible for what happened to the Nostromo. My suspicion is they wanted to use the crew members as incubators for the xenomorphs, and Ash as a robot could perform any needed experiments without being targeted by the creatures.
Good call on the Weyland-Yutani using Ash because the xenomorphs would not impregnate him, and using human hosts for the xenomorphs by any means necessary is 100% the MO of the company. We are so on the same page here. But just as a little side note about that attack on Ripley, apparently Scott and the writers were trying to do a sort of rape scene with Ash and Ripley there. Of course, you couldn't do that with a synthetic and a human, and so you get a metaphor of Ash rolling up the magazine and trying to shove it into Ripley's mouth rather than just strangle her or something. Honestly, though, thinking about that scene like that kind of ruins it for me, even if it's the only explanation for a very phallic rolled up magazine attack.
Yeah, I'm better off for not knowing that either. I can't watch that scene very well to this day. It makes me uncomfortable. That said, I can't deny that even though it's really unsavory, it's in keeping with the themes of the film. I mean, the xenomorph is a metaphor for that kind of violation. So I get where that scene comes from on a craft level, but I just can't help but find it repellent.
It does fit the theme with the xenomorphs, and perhaps he even chose to go through Ripley's mouth like they do out of his fascination with them. But three words for all of that. Click, click, deleted. Let's get back to the xenomorphs, though. I was thinking about how quickly the xenomorphs grow and how much biological energy it must take to do that so rapidly, and I can't help but wonder if part of the reason of the xenomorphs kills was for food to produce said biological energy, even if they didn't need to take in very much. I mean, it's pretty obvious that the xenomorph and alien was one of the warrior types of xenomorphs, and they often choose to capture their prey rather than kill them, which seems to be to feed the queen and the facehuggers needing hosts for food. But I have to assume that there is some type of consuming going on there with the kills, as it is biologically impossible to just be born with that much energy.
That's a question that Jeff Bracey is better equipped to answer than me. But it is true that that kind of mass has to come from somewhere. So it could be that the xenomorph has to feed on the meat of other creatures to sustain its super fast metabolism.
I guess I want to even take it back to the Valiant comic character Bloodshot, who can fully regenerate, regrow, and heal, but he requires protein to do it. There is this scene where people and a couple of kids have to look away as he devours a cow. But maybe you're right, and I should bounce that off of Bracey. So if we could just switch over to some of the making of and behind the scenes stuff. Alien's original writer, Dan O'Bannon, had created Alien with Ron Shusett, actually worked with John Carpenter on his master's thesis film called Dark Star in 1974 with Alien concept artist Ron Cobb, which was essentially a sci-fi comedy. And just to give you a taste, it was essentially truckers in space. And the alien in Dark Star was actually a beach ball. Apparently, they actually tried to get it into theaters, but were ultimately unsuccessful as the film did not meet industry standards at the time. But a couple of years later, O'Bannon decided to rewrite Dark Star as a horror movie with a more realistic alien than a beach ball. That wouldn't be hard to do, honestly, if beach ball was the bar there. But O'Bannon actually had the first half of the movie written all the way up until the crew went down to LV-426. But he wasn't sure what to do with the second half. He knew that he had to get the alien on board the ship in an interesting way, but he couldn't figure it out. So he told Ron Shusett about it. And after a dream, he came back with the idea for the facehugger, which would essentially perform an interspecies rape against the host and put its seed in them. Dan O'Bannon loved the idea and thought that it hit all of the right buttons and really made what was then called Star Beast into a movie worth doing. Through the writing process, the name got changed from Dark Star to Star Beast, among other names, but he didn't like them. However, one day he noticed that throughout the script he originally wrote, they kept referring to the creature as the alien, and it just kind of jumped out at him as the perfect name for the film. But you'll note that nobody refers to the alien in the film, and that's because they didn't get a producer and a distributor involved to make the film, and of course, they had to put their 2 cents into the film when they did. They got the fledgling company Brandywine Productions, founded by Gordon Carroll, David Giler, and Walter Hill, to produce the film without even telling writer Dan and O'Bannon all that they had decided to do. David Giler and Walter Hill basically hijacked the script and rewrote a bunch of the stuff so that they could get the writing credit on the film, too. They initially attempted to do minor things to the script, just enough to get a credit for a substantial rewrite of the script. Like, David Giler came in one day and randomly and without any real explanation says that he hates everyone's names on the script. This was a ploy to get the credit because Giler was under the false assumption that changing the names would be a substantial enough change to the script to get the credit he was hounding after. Ultimately, David Giler and Walter Hill changed most of the dialogue. They added Ash, the android, and a few other minor things. The end result, according to Dan O'Bannon, was it was his story after having been in a car wreck. One contribution that Fox added to the script was actually real positive was that the characters in the film were all originally written as men, but Fox asked if there was any reason that Ripley couldn't be a woman, and the writers agreed that while having a woman in the lead role of a sci-fi horror movie was rare, it would work. When the writers went for that, Fox later changed Lambert's character to a woman as well. Fox's hope was to ride the coattails of the women's liberation movement that was going on at the time, and that having two women on the show would broaden the audience. They could not have been more right.
Oh, true. Now, the Dark Star connection is interesting. As it happens, I've actually seen this film, so I can talk about some of the alien connections. I think Dan O'Bannon was right to just start over and borrow elements of Dark Star, because I don't think it would have worked in its original form. The thing with Dark Star is that it was meant to be at least partly comedic, and it works much better as a straight horror. The other issue is that Dark Star is several different stories crammed together. It's partly the chase against the beach ball alien, but it's also a Dr. Strangelove-style comedy of errors farce about the bomb going off and then a malfunctioning laser. The characters in Dark Star are also not nearly as memorable as the cast of Alien, so the changes they made to the characters were all improvements in my view. But I think there are some definite parallels where you can see the influence. Harry Dean Stanton's character definitely takes elements of Pym back from Dark Star. He's the menial worker who doesn't get much respect from anybody. I was reminded quite a bit of Stanton's death scene during the beach ball chase with Pym back too. The ship design of the Dark Star has some stylistic influences with the Nostromo as well. These are very lived-in and rugged-looking ships, as opposed to the pristine, futuristic ships that we see in most SF films. You get to see Pinback digging around through vents and ducts like Dallas does on the Nostromo. Oh, and here's a fun fact, and I have no idea if it influenced Cameron at all, but you see one of the astronauts in Dark Star playing the same knife game that Hudson and Bishop play in Aliens.
I'm just going to come right out and say that cannot be a coincidence.
you could well be right on that. It does seem odd. Anyway, I think making Ripley a female character absolutely works. I mean, I think it makes one change for the positive, if anything. Given that the alien is an allegory for the threat of sexual violence, I feel like the change gives it more potency. Again, a very unsavory kind of allegory, but if you're going to go that way, might as well go all the way with it.
Totally. But let's talk about getting the right folks involved. Apparently, even after Brandywine Productions came on, they had a hard time selling the script to studios initially, and they had shopped it around quite a bit. But that all changed in 1977 when Star Wars came out. Suddenly, sci-fi was the next big thing, and all the studios were scrambling to make one. Over at Fox, they were hoping to catch the craze too, but the only sci-fi script they had sitting around was Alien, and so they greenlit the film just like that.
Wow, sometimes all you need is to get a project going is the right timing. Even though Alien is a very different kind of film than Star Wars, it was able to benefit from its success in an indirect way, and then the Alien franchise was able to become a huge success in its own right, but they still had one more hurdle to overcome. They needed someone who could direct it. So how did Ridley Scott get involved with the film?
After getting the distributor and the production company involved, the next big step was to find a director with the vision to make the film how it needed to be. But they ran into two problems while searching for a director. The first was that all of the A-list directors didn't want anything to do with the film, and many referred to it as a dumb monster movie. The other problem is that they wanted to make the B-movie story of Alien and turn it into an A-movie, and those who were willing to do it just did not get what they wanted to do with the film. One director, and check this out, I can't believe this, one director, when asked how he would do the facehugger scene in the movie, said he would just go down to the supermarket and get a liver and throw it on his face. Imagine that. So that was clearly the wrong choice for what they were aiming for. But luckily, the studio came across The Duelist by Ridley Scott, and they loved his control of the film and his camera work on it. So the studio sent Scott a copy of the script, and within 26 hours, he was standing in Hollywood having agreed to do the film. Bear in mind, he was in the UK when he read the script. That's some fast work going there. This would be Scott's first real dealings with Hollywood. But they had a few meetings, and afterwards they were convinced that Scott could give them the A-movie feel they were looking for. Scott went home and storyboarded the whole film, something he would do on all of his movies, to my knowledge. After 3 weeks of drawing, Scott brought the storyboards to the studio, and after looking at them, instead of saying it was way over budget, the studio straight up doubled the budget from $4.2 million to $8.4 million. Million to accomplish Ridley Scott's vision. It would, of course, go up to $11 million by the end of it all, but still. To give you an idea about these storyboards, Scott was highly influenced by 2001, The Space Odyssey, Star Wars, and Heavy Metal Magazine, particularly the work of Jean Moebius Guiraud.
I have to say how much I love Sir Ridley's influences on these movies. But it sounds like Alien was the film that gave Ridley Scott his big break across the pond, so to speak. I mean, it's definitely true he had the right influences and the right grounding in science fiction to handle a film like Alien. He turned out to be absolutely the right choice to helm this movie, and I can't imagine anyone else doing half as well with a movie like this.
Oh, they definitely scored picking up Ridley Scott, and Alien was no doubt Scott's big break over here. Ridley Scott has a great visual style, and he was really able to take their B-movie script and make it an A-movie production. In The Beast Within, The Making of Alien, Ridley Scott says that he's a huge fan of Tobe Hooper's Texas Chainsaw Massacre from 1974. In fact, in an interview, he says that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is the perfect horror film. I'm going to disagree with Scott there, but I do like what he took from that and brought to Alien was that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre had a lot of implied violence. The kind where you are shown just enough to let your imagination fill in the blanks. And if that style of directing sounds familiar to you, Steve, it's because both Hooper and Ridley Scott also draw on the great Alfred Hitchcock as influences in both the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Alien. They seem to draw from 1960s Psycho in particular, but also Hitchcock's general style. I thought you would appreciate that, Steve. Ridley Scott said that the more you see of the monster, the less scary it will become. What's more was that if you knew the monster was there but couldn't see it, the tension would be even higher than it would be if you could actually see the monster.
Yeah, I can appreciate both of those influences. I think the elements of Texas Chainsaw Massacre that work do come through in Alien, since you mentioned that. That movie's all about using the setting to up the creep factor and then bringing in the monster at the right moments. Alien draws on that approach as well. I'm also not surprised to hear that Psycho was name-dropped as well. I mean, Alien does work on that psychological level that worked for Hitchcock. I mean, sure, you get really graphic stuff like the dinner table scene, but many other scenes only show bits of the alien, and you don't often see him do anything too graphic and in a direct way. You don't really need to show anything that crazy after the chestburster scene, because you can imagine what isn't shown.
Yeah, the trick is really knowing how close to make the connection so that the viewer's mind can build the bridge. And Scott, Hooper, and Hitchcock are all pretty good at that, although Hitchcock gets the OG credit on that list. So with Scott on board and things really rolling with the script, the next big step was going to be design. The Xenomorph was, as well as anything alien-related and things not from Earth, were designed by the Swiss artist H.R. Giger. He was hired on after they saw his book of art called The Necronomicon. And I actually have to take a minute to talk about Giger. He was a very strange individual, and he always wore black. He lived alone with his pets in a house. His house was full of all kinds of bones and skeletons. He had a real fascination with the organic and with twisting what it could become or look like. And honestly, his artwork can be pretty disturbing at times. In fact, Giger has himself said that his own artwork haunted him and disturbed him. That, of course, made it perfect for the Xenomorph and other alien stuff. But the studio did not initially agree. They said that Giger's work was too ghastly and that people wouldn't like it. What they failed to realize right away was that the ghastly and disturbing quality of Giger's art was exactly why they wanted him to work on the project. It is a horror movie, after all. Disturbing goes with the package. Ridley Scott, in particular, loved Giger's design for the Xenomorph and said that it was both beautiful and threatening, with a bit of a sexual connotation to it. Giger specifically designed the Xenomorph without any eyes because he thought it would be scarier if you couldn't tell where the creature was looking. But the combination of what he did, rumors about what was in his house, and his kind of vampire-like appearance really made a lot of the crew want to avoid him. But in truth, Giger is a very kind and gentle man. He just has some morbid curiosities. The rest of the designing, including the interior and exterior of the ship, and basically all of the human and earth related things, were designed by concept artists Ron Cobb and Chris Foss.
It is true that Giger had some strange ideas and a very weird visual aesthetic, but aside from that, he was a cool guy from all the accounts I've heard. I mean, his work is extremely Lovecraftian in his design as well, but as he said, that's exactly what a good horror film needed, and his Xenomorph design is iconic for a reason. Nobody had ever seen anything like that design before. It's just unnerving, especially a monster with no eyes. I mean, I think that triggers a psychological effect in people because the eyes are the windows to the soul. The implication is that the Xenomorph is a soulless monster who only exists to procreate and feed. I can't imagine this movie doing as well without someone like Giger designing the creature. It is certainly a huge improvement over the beach ball alien from Dark Star.
I hadn't picked up on that, the eyes are the windows to the soul angle before, but that is certainly in there too. In hand-to-hand combat, they teach you the importance of looking your opponent in the eye, in part because of what you said there, Steve, that it tells the emotional state, but it also gives you an idea of where they will attack or move to. The eyes are a huge part of communication, and removing them from the Xenomorph adds a terrifying enigma to their intentions and actions. So really, I think that works on a couple of levels.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it gets across how truly alien a being that the Xenomorph is as well. There is nothing human inside this creature, even if it was born from a human.
Oh, for sure. While they bond with the DNA of the host, they clearly have hardwired traits and features too that keep them true. But if we could switch to talking about Ridley Scott for a minute, you know, we speculated that Ridley Scott would manipulate and abuse the actors on set to get a certain reaction or emotion from them when we talked about Blade Runner. Well, I flat out heard Ridley Scott say that he did as much on the set of Alien. He would goad the actors while they worked, ignore them just to piss them off. And it was not just ignoring. Scott would deliberately start talking to someone else while the actor was speaking to him. Ridley really liked to get honest emotion out of his actors, and in the chestburster scene, he made sure he would get them. In the script, all it said about the chestburster scene was that a monster would come out of his chest, but nobody knew how it would happen or what the creature would look like, not even when they were setting up the scene. All the actors were deliberately kept in the dark about what was happening, and all had to stay in their trailers, except for John Hurt, of course, who had played Kane. Finally, the actors were brought onto the set. Nobody was prepared for John Hurt's amazing performance, which just sucked them into the moment. All of the blood and the chest buster itself. Veronica Cartwright was told she would get a little blood, but in fact got a whole jet stream of blood right in her face. The reactions you see from everyone in large part are real, and they only did that scene once. So that should give you an idea of Scott's directing and style, and prove that he did in fact do similar things on Blade Runner set, if not more so. There weren't anyone who quit movies altogether after working on Alien, so I imagine things were even worse on Blade Runner. And on the set of Alien, Ridley Scott was not the only provocateur on the set. Yoffit, who played Parker, gave Weaver a really hard time, and she flat out got pissed at him on set. That scene where she's yelling at Parker to shut up and listen to her was genuine anger from Sigourney at Yoffit, but Ridley just kept on filming, and Weaver managed to stay in character, and that's the take we got in the film.
Wow. Sir John Hurt is an acting legend on so many films and shows he's done for the years, but nobody's ever going to forget that scene. I mean, Hurt sells Kane's death really well, and that moment sells the threat of the xenomorph going forward. No doubt that Ridley Scott was up to his old method trickery with this film. We saw him do similar things in Brave Runner, as you pointed out. I mean, it makes sense that he would try to get genuine reactions from the cast of the chestburster as much as possible, and it certainly worked. I mean, everyone in that scene looked genuinely shocked by what's going on, and so their reaction and confusion looks believable on screen.
Scott can be a bit of a jerk, but there is no denying that what he does works and works well. And you're right, serious props to John Hurt in that scene. He really sold it. Maybe even sold it a little too well. Audiences apparently really freaked out over the chestburster scene. Several people threw up. A girl passed out in the theater. Many people left the theater or even moved back several rows so they weren't sitting as close to the screen. Despite all of this, however, a ton of people went to see the film, in large part because of the ad campaign and the tagline, "In space, no one can hear you scream."
I can believe it. I mean, that's a very difficult scene to watch, no matter how many times I watch this movie. It's a brilliantly staged scene where it starts off as a normal dinner, and then Kane starts convulsing, and the nightmare begins from there. The practical effects are top-notch in that scene, and it's gruesome and horrifying to this day. I love that scene and how well it's directed and executed by the entire cast, but man, it's painful and disturbing to sit through, which makes it all the more amazing that the sequel actually improves on this movie, if anything. So what are your thoughts on Aliens, Mike?
Aliens, as we discussed before on our Patreon exclusive top 10 perfect 10 films list, is a major favorite for both of us, and it's a big reason why James Cameron came up twice on that list. It is the perfect combination of action, sci-fi, and horror. So perfect, in fact, that I have not seen its equal in the genre.
I haven't either. I mean, there are also no military science fiction films that hit the mark for me the way this one does either, and there have been quite a few out there since Aliens was first released.
Yeah, Aliens is a real high point in Cameron's career and a jewel in his crown. He really just nailed it with Aliens. But speaking of Aliens, let's get into it. Aliens came out in 1986 and was written and directed by my man James Cameron, based on the story by Cameron, Walter Hill, and David Giler from Brandywine Productions. The film has a great cast, including Sigourney Weaver, who reprises her role as Ellen Ripley, Michael Biehn, who plays Corporal Dwayne Hicks, Bill Paxton as Private Hudson, Johnson. William Hope as the Colonel Marines Commanding Officer, Lieutenant Gorman. Al Matthews as Sergeant Apone, a guy who with actual military experience that really helped bring some authenticity to the Colonial Marines. Paul Reiser, in his only villain role that I'm aware of, plays Carter J. Burke, a Weyland-Yutani Corporation representative. Lance Henderson rocks it as the android bishop, and Carrie Hinn plays the young girl Newt. It should be noted that Carrie Hinn had absolutely no acting experience before working on Aliens.
Yeah, I think that James Cameron honestly does something brilliant with Aliens. I mean, he knew there was no way he could beat Ridley Scott at his own game, and it wasn't even worth trying to do that in his eyes. So his solution to that problem was to follow up Alien with a different kind of film, but one that was true to its roots. So rather than playing it up as a horror, I mean, Cameron kept some of the horror elements, but made it into a military science fiction film. And honestly, it's probably the best film of military SF to date, even better than Starship Troopers. And the book started off this entire subgenre. Cameron mentioned in his introduction to the director's cut of Aliens that he was influenced heavily by the Vietnam War, and that definitely plays out in this film. Everything Cameron introduces here takes the xenomorph to the next level, while respecting the emotional journey of Ellen Ripley that was started in the first film.
He really did take things to the next level and clearly had a great respect for the 79 film. He firmly establishes the link between the two films and their stories first in a very just let the story untold fashion. And I think that showed a lot of respect to both Ridley Scott and the movie to firmly connect the films before cranking it up to 11. I'm not certain I can agree that Cameron did Space Marines better than Starship Troopers, as that film takes it all the way from basic training into the great victory, into the first great victory of the war. But from what we get of the unit and Aliens, I can say that they felt more akin to a specialized unit like Dutch and his men from Predator rather than from the military. And I say this because there was a bit too much lip and back talk and disregard for orders on the part of the team to be attached to the authoritative and rigid military. I mean, you don't see much of that in Starship Troopers, and it's a big deal when they violate orders. I can agree that they are really good, but maybe for me, Starship Troopers is the gold standard there. And so I maybe I'm biased. But I would also like to add that I did really like the Colonial Marines and Aliens, and I thought they were really well done. It's just the better than Starship Troopers thing. But I've rambled on about this enough.
Oh, that's fair. My problem with Starship Troopers is how far the film strayed from the book, and it didn't really seem to get what Heinlein was going for, but that's a completely different discussion, and I think we can agree on the stuff that concerns the aliens.
Nice. Sweet amicability. Now, I have to admit that it's been a while since I watched the theatrical releases of the first four Alien films. I always watch the special or extended edition of the films, so if I say something is in the film that you don't remember, that is likely why. With Aliens, for instance, the theatrical cut was 2 hours and 17 minutes, but the special edition is a full 20 minutes longer and is, in fact, James Cameron's favorite version of the film. I guess one of Cameron's friends described Aliens as 40 miles of bad road, and even though conventional thinking at the time was to have a shorter movie, the special edition is the version Cameron intended the viewers to take.
Definitely. I've only seen the special edition, but that one is always the version that I watch. I don't think there's a single frame in that version that I would lose from the film. So whatever they added in is something that makes the film better. That suggests to me that Cameron knew what he was doing and that the decisions he made in the process were the correct ones.
Oh, yeah. Both Cameron and Scott have the film already made in their minds, down to the minutiae of it all. And quite frankly, they are right no matter what someone else says.
Yep. Both of the director's cuts are better than the theatrical cuts, and those are the versions I watch. But let's get into the film itself.
You know, they really make a point of how Gorman is inexperienced by saying that he's only had two combat drops, including the one they were on. He apparently had 38 simulated drops, though, but I'm honestly not sure how someone that green could have gotten a commanding position, or any ranked position for that matter. But it gets worse, as he has no idea what possible dangers might be there, even though the Weyland-Yutani Corporation makes the terraformers that they were in and could have easily studied that information beforehand, as I think any good commander would have. I mean, how does one plan to lead a mission without knowing everything there is to know going in? I would think it would be impossible to lead effectively without that knowledge. And what do you know? That's exactly what happens with Gorman. He has to be told by Ripley and Burke that the terraformers are basically nuclear reactors. So instead of being able to have his soldiers prepared to fight without their guns, they have to improvise on the spot and try to survive. That, of course, leads to that some of them using guns there anyway. Then when things go to shit, the very inexperienced commander panics as he watches the soldiers die one by one, and he just sits there frozen. All of that elaboration to say, I think the company put Gorman and the Colonial Marines on that mission so that they could be hosts for the Xenomorphs. And before you think that's crazy, consider that the company was willing to put up billions on a terraforming front, all so that they could use the colonists in their experiments with the Xenomorphs in the lab they built on LV-426. The company didn't go back to save the colonists. They went back for specimens and maybe even data from the lab. Obviously, things went bad. My guess is that it was something like what happened on the station in Alien Resurrection, where things got out of hand and the place was just overrun by xenomorphs. I also assume that, like Alien Resurrections, all of the staff likely were killed or escaped. It is just a theory, but I think having evil scientist humans on LV-426 explains why Newt was afraid when she saw other humans. I get why she would have been afraid of the xenomorphs, but something made her fear humans as well. What do you think about all of that, Steve?
Well, I'll preface this by saying that while I've not personally served, I've spent much of my life around people who have. So I'll give you my perspective on this. There are a number of Murphy's Laws of Combat that are sometimes cited within the military. Things like friendly fire isn't. And never forget that your weapon is made by the lowest bidder. The one that is most relevant here is there's nothing more dangerous than a second lieutenant with a map. That is Gorman's entire character in a nutshell. While his inexperience and cluelessness may be exaggerated for the purposes of this film, it is very true that officers often were not as reliable as the NCOs serving under them, like a Pone in this case, and he is very competent. And to be fair to Gorman, he does get better by the time he finally bites it. Still, I think you could be onto something with the idea that the Colonial Marines were set up to be xenomorph fodder. We saw Weyland-Yutani do the exact same thing with the Nostromo crew. Also, Burke set the whole thing up, and he was willing to sacrifice Ripley and Newt to the aliens. I mean, I do not have any doubt that Burke or Weyland-Yutani would have been willing to feed the Marines to the xenomorphs as well if it meant bringing back live samples for the company to experiment on. They could have put an unqualified officer in command on purpose to make that easier, certainly.
Awesome. Same page there then. And that was some good insight on how things can be done in a military structure. I didn't know that. I can't help but notice all of the bug hunt references by the Colonial Marines. As a guy who has watched Starship Troopers about 15 times, that is where my mind goes when I hear that. Now, I can't verify this, but I would not be surprised if Cameron had read the 1959 novel Starship Troopers by Robert A. Heinlein, and that was part of the inspiration for the Colonial Marines. I mean, there are a lot of similarities from what I can tell.
I'm pretty sure that was intentional, yes. I think the idea absolutely was to do Starship Troopers by way of Alien. I'm also fairly sure Cameron probably read the Heinlein novel. The aliens in that story were called bugs, in fact. Starship Troopers is a definitive novel of military science fiction, so Cameron using it as an inspiration totally makes sense to me.
Sweet. I'm glad I'm not the only one who saw that, because I couldn't verify it anywhere. But speaking of the Colonial Marines, I'd like to talk about one of them, Private Hudson. Is the textbook case shit talker. In my experience, the guy doing most of the talking has the least skill, and they are using their mouths to compensate for the lack. He is all full of piss and vinegar at the beginning when he thought it would be just like all the other bug hunts they had been on, where I'm assuming the things they were fighting or killing were not a real threat. But when he is presented with real danger and dire straits, his paper castle of strength and confidence goes up in flames. By the time everyone else is trying to figure out what to do next, all he has left are ashes.
Everything you say about Hudson is true. I mean, he's all talk and swagger until he realizes how screwed they are, and then he's paralyzed by fear. Contrast that to Ripley, who starts off traumatized, but she's able to overcome her fear to make sure everyone gets out alive. But I will say that the kind of locker room talk you get from the Marines is very consistent with what I know of military life. I mean, soldiers mess around with each other constantly, and there's a certain kind of language that they use that civilians just don't. I feel like everything you hear in this movie sounds like what soldiers would say in that situation. And you do often get jokers like Hudson in the middle of that. I'm pretty sure that Cameron did his homework on this one. And it helps to have people like Al Matthews, who was a real soldier before doing this film.
Matthews helped a lot from what I can tell. And it sounds like Cameron did do his homework as far as assembling the team. But the Colonial Marines were not the only badasses in the film. Ripley really delivers on the final girl badassery in Aliens, and I want to talk about that for a second. Now, everybody talks about her fighting the Queen in the end and protecting Newt, and Ripley's, "Get away from her, you bitch!" It's a classic line for sure. But I want to spotlight another scene that really stands out as awesome to me. A great final girl has to be smart. She's got to be resourceful and brave, and I think Ripley exemplifies all of those things in a single scene when her and Newt are trapped in the room by Burke with not one but two face huggers, and both Newt and Ripley scramble to get their backs up against the wall, and Newt says that she's scared, and Ripley admits that she is too, but she's able to think and act on her feet despite her great fear. First, she does her best to get a hold of Hicks by the way of the cameras, but Burke shuts them off before Hicks can see them. So by Newt's suggestion, she tries to break the soundproof window, which obviously wasn't going to happen. But you can see her scanning the room, looking for any possibility, and she finds it and sets off the fire alarm with her lighter, which is guaranteed to get Hicks' attention. And both her and Newt are able to fight off their respective face huggers until Hicks and the others can get in there. Burke thought he had that all set up, but Ripley outthought him. Plus, I'm going to give Final Girl points to Newt as well there for surviving all that time and fighting her own face hugger.
Totally agreed. I mean, what I love about this movie is that it's about Ripley overcoming her trauma from the last film. I mean, she was messed up so badly by the alien that she's having these terrible nightmares every night, and she's had to live with the deaths of everyone she couldn't save. And then on top of that, she comes home to find out that she's outlived her only child. That would mess up anybody. But this movie pushes Ripley to confront the fears that have been holding her back, and finding Newt helps her heal those old wounds. Ripley finds the strength within herself to do things she would never have found imaginable at the start of the film, because she has these people who are depending on her, and so she has to fight for them. So deep down, Ripley is fighting to save Newt, this kid who she starts to see as her own child. And I also love that Ripley and the Xenomorph Queen are fighting for the exact same reasons, even if they're on completely opposite sides.
That's insightful, and I like the character arc in the movie looking at it that way. Ripley is able to heal and overcome by having more than herself to fight for, and the breach of outliving her daughter is mended to some degree by Newt. Ripley definitely could not have done those things before Newt. Even when she goes to save the Marines when Gorman messes up, she is acting out of panic, and Hicks even has to calm her down when they've actually gotten away. It's like her fight or flight response just went off, and she was all instinct at that point. But she gained strength and clarity, forming a relationship with Newt. I think that's why that scene where Ripley is desperately looking for Newt and following the tracker on Newt's watch, only to find the watch Newt had been wearing inside the Queen's lair on the ground, with Newt nowhere to be found, was so heartbreaking. Now, I haven't had to look for a child, adopted or otherwise, but I can imagine Ripley holding on to being able to track Newt as her last hope, and finding that watch on the ground just ripped it from her. She has nothing now, no way of reaching Newt. Luckily, Newt screams and Ripley is able to find her, but that scene was harsh, and Weaver delivered that pain very well. I definitely felt it.
Yeah, this is the dark night of the soul part of the story, where Ripley has to face what she fears more than anything, which is losing Newt to the same kind of monster that killed the Nostromo. It truly is frightening, especially to anyone who's a parent, but I think it shows how much Ripley has embraced her role as Newt's foster mother, that she's willing to go through everything she hates and fears most in order to get her kid back, even if it means possibly dying herself. That there is real parental love.
Definitely. And as a parent, it was extra frightening. But if we could switch over to the making of and behind the scenes section of our Aliens discussion, I'd like to talk a bit about my favorite director, James Cameron, and his role in the film. Now, there were lots of behind-the-scenes garbage that stalled Aliens from getting made, from Fox's doubts that a sequel would be anything but a disaster to Brandywine Productions having to sue Fox for unpaid profits in order to get them to make the film, and a whole bunch of stuff in between that we just don't have the time to go over here. But suffice it to say that things eventually got going. Now, the original script that David Giler had going for what was then just called Alien 2 was a cross between the film Southern Comfort and The Magnificent Seven. So it makes sense that Giler and Hill's suggestion on writing the story was basically Ripley and soldiers. Giler's development executive, Larry Wilson, began looking for a scriptwriter in mid-1983 when he came across the script for Terminator by James Cameron that was currently in development. Wilson liked the Terminator script, but held off on showing it to Giler here in Hill and Carroll at Brandywine Productions. That is until he saw James Cameron's collaborative work with Sylvester Stallone on Rambo First Blood Part 2 that same year, and Wilson was convinced enough to show the script for the Terminator to Giler, Hill, and Carroll. I don't know why that is such a tongue twister for me. Brandywine Productions liked what they saw, and by November of 1983, Cameron submitted a 42-page film treatment for Aliens 2 that he had written in 3 days. Now, if you're like me, you're asking, what the hell is a film treatment? A treatment is a document that presents the story idea of a film before writing the entire script. Treatments are often written in present tense, in narrative-like prose, and highlight the most important information about the film, including the title, the logline, story summary, and character descriptions. So that was what Cameron presented to Fox, and Fox absolutely loved Cameron's treatment, even if it was unfinished. At the time, Cameron was busy working on The Terminator, and that short treatment was all that he had time to do. But when production on The Terminator was delayed for 9 months because Arnold Schwarzenegger was contractually obligated to film Conan the Destroyer, Cameron used the time to develop his treatment and expanded it to 90 pages of script. Unfortunately, at 90 pages, he was still only in the second act of the film. But at that point, Arnold became free and James Cameron had to go off and finish his film. But Fox and Brandywine Productions loved what Cameron had written and actually did something that studios never do, and that was actually wait until Cameron was done with Terminator so that he could finish the script. But Cameron was able to turn in the finished script for Alien 2 by February 1985. Honestly, Cameron was able to put so much into the Alien 2 script because he had such low expectations with the Terminator. He ended up spending most of his free time during the production of Terminator developing and trying out ideas for Alien 2. In fact, my guess is he felt like Alien 2 was his baby at that point, and that is why he wanted to direct the film too. Initially, Cameron was viewed as too inexperienced a director until both the studio and Cameron were both surprised by the financial success of The Terminator. After that, the studio agreed to let him direct. Now, from what I can, what I understand, working with Cameron on this film was difficult for the crew at Pinewood Studios in Buckinghamshire near London, England. Not only was Cameron aggressive and sure of what he wanted, which pissed off the crew who wanted to do things their way, he would often do things himself rather than use their unionized crew. Plus, being Canadian, Cameron was really frustrated by the workable hours available in a day, being interrupted for every little thing, including tea breaks, which frustrated Cameron to no end. He hated tea breaks. I won't talk about it all, but I find it ironic that Fox didn't approach Ridley Scott about the sequel because he was too difficult to work with the first time. And then they got James Cameron, who was equally demanding and frustrating. But I'll tell you this, it may have been a nightmare to work with Ridley Scott or James Cameron back in the day, but no one can deny the quality of the work that was produced. Alien and Aliens are 100% the best films of the franchise.
Absolutely. You know, it seems to be a recurring theme with James Cameron that the studio pushes back against him until they realize that he rakes in a ton of money. I mean, even after Titanic, he had these kinds of arguments with the studios until he reminded them how much money he brought in. I mean, it is true that Cameron had a problem with the crew. I mean, they were an English crew that they had brought in from Pinewood Studios, and they were loyal to Derek Cracknell, who was the assistant director that they had worked with for a long time. The problem was that Cracknell often wanted to change things without Cameron's approval, and Cameron was finally forced to fire him. That decision nearly stopped production because the English crew was loyal to Cracknell. Fortunately, Sigourney Weaver got involved, and she was able to unite the crew behind Cameron's vision for the film. So the crew all respected Sigourney, and I think that that possibly ended up saving the movie after all the behind-the-scenes tension.
It is true that Sigourney Weaver definitely saved that film by stepping in and reuniting everyone under one banner. With as great a film as they ended up with, it all could have been all could have crashed and burned if not for Weaver. My guess is that's why she came on as a co-producer in the next film and a producer on Alien Resurrection. But let's talk about Alien 3, which was stylized as Alien to the Power of 3. Alien 3 came out in 1992 and was directed by the then unknown David Fincher, at least in film anyway. But he would go on to do 1995 7 and, as his second film, and 7 a personal favorite of mine. But back to Alien 3, the script was written and rewritten by 9 writers, but the final version we see in the film was written by David Giler, Walter Hill, and Larry Ferguson from a story by Vincent Ward. But we will get into all of that garbage in a bit. Alien 3 stars Charles S. Dutton as Leonard Dillon, one of Fiorina's inmates, who functions as a spiritual and de facto leader amongst the prisoners and attempts to keep them keep peace in the facility. Charles Dance is Jonathan Clemens, a former inmate who now serves as the facility's doctor. Brian Glover is Harold Andrews, the prison warden. Ralph Brown is Francis Aaron, a.k.a. 85, the assistant of the superintendent Andrews. Lance Henriksen as the voice of the damaged Bishop android, as well as playing a character credited as Bishop 2, who appears in the film's final scenes, claiming to be the human designer of the android, who wants the alien queen that was growing inside Ripley for the use of Weyland-Yutani's bioweapons division. The character is identified as Michael Bishop Weyland, and in tie-in materials to Alien and the video games Aliens Colonial Marines.
Don't even get me started on Aliens Colonial Marines. But I honestly feel bad for David Fincher with this movie. He got some flack for this film, but it's not Fincher's fault at all. The studio apparently wanted to go against everything that Cameron built in the last film, and they wanted a director who would play ball with the studio and do what they wanted. Fincher by that time had mostly been making music videos, and I think he was a bit too experienced about the Hollywood system, and he didn't know exactly what he was getting himself into at that time. The studio probably felt that they could steer a director like that, but they underestimated him. Fincher was a director with a clear vision for his movie, and he wasn't putting up with the studio's interference. I think Fincher did the best he could with what he had, but the studio ended up tying his hands. Alien 3, unfortunately, damaged Fincher's career for years, and it took the success of 7 to show what Fincher was capable of as a director.
It's true that Fincher had plenty of difficulties working on Alien 3, but he did continue the pedigree of relatively unknown directors that worked on the Alien franchise and went on to becoming big names in Hollywood. I mean, Ridley Scott, James Cameron, David Fincher, these are big names now.
These are some truly great directors that this series has had. I mean, I just wish that Fincher had gotten the respect that his predecessors had. If so, I think we would have gotten a much better film.
I definitely agree. And honestly, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me to hire a director and then work behind his back and even against him at times. I mean, they were just cutting off their own feet there. But let's get into the film a bit. If I were Ripley, I would have a hatred for stasis or cryo chambers. I mean, every time she goes into one, bad things happen while she's asleep. She battles and survives a nightmare and then goes back into stasis and things actually get worse. And on that note, do you think that after hearing the company did not believe her until it was too late, that Ripley was hesitant to tell Dr. Clemens about the xenomorphs? If that's not it, I don't get the hesitation.
First off, I have to say what a dirty move it was to kill off Newt and Hicks between movies like this. I mean, even if they couldn't get the original actors back, this is a bad way to write their characters out. And this was done by the studio. On top of that, it just destroys Ripley's entire character arc from the last film. I mean, Ripley learns to face her fears, move past her trauma, and rebuild the family that she lost. And now she loses everything again, and she has nothing left. On top of that, she's slowly dying because of the thing growing inside her. It's so bleak and nihilistic, and it leaves Ripley without any hope at all, and I hate that.
That was a terrible way to deal with those characters, and it does ruin a lot of what happened before. But if it makes you feel any better, Hicks and Newt both survive in the Dark Horse comics.
Well, I guess there is that at least. I mean, as to your question about Clemens, that may very well be the case. Ripley by now has twice had to deal with conspiracies involving Weyland-Yutani, both times having to deal with a traitor in her midst, first with Ash and then with Burke. So after that, I don't blame her for being hesitant with someone she doesn't know too well yet.
Yeah, that is totally understandable reaction. They were just not that clear about it in the film, but I'm glad we went the same direction with that. So it certainly seems like the Weyland-Yutani Corporation had its fingers in a bit of everything, kind of reminiscent of the Umbrella Corporation, but like on a galactic level. They were mining and hauling ore and alien, terraforming and building space stations and even toys in aliens and even prison colonies and refineries in Alien 3. Not to mention, they apparently have a bioweapons division, which might date back to Alien, which is also a lot like the Umbrella Corporation.
They're basically the Amazon of the alien future. I think that makes sense, though. I mean, corporate power tends to consolidate in the hands of fewer and fewer companies over time. And it makes sense that Weyland-Yutani would be able to leverage that into dominance of other industries as well.
Very true. I might put Weyland-Yutani up there with the Wallace Corporation from Blade Runner 2049 in that respect. But back to Alien 3. So in Alien 3, we get introduced to a new kind of facehugger. It happens in the scene where we see those two guys cleaning a cow that they are going to put into the stew for chow. One of those guys picks up a massive facehugger. Not only is it bigger, it has more legs and even webbing between the legs and a longer, thicker tail. Now, I can't help but notice that this new facehugger, called a royal facehugger, by the way, because it contains a queen embryo, was found dead among the cow's corpses. And it would take a considerably bigger facehugger to impregnate a cow than it would for a human. That seems to imply that the eggs or pods themselves might have been aware on some level, as xenomorphs are known for their adaptability. Perhaps the egg adjusted the facehugger inside. It sounds crazy, but it's the only explanation I have for the royal facehugger being there. But speaking of the cows and the royal facehugger, Alien 3 is the first time we get to see a xenomorph born from something other than a human. Xenomorphs bond with their host's DNA, and in the same way, a child is a blend of their parents' DNA. And so when the xenomorph is born of a cow, not a human, it's going to move differently. It's going to come out looking differently than we've seen before. And apparently, it's going to be larger, too, even in the chestburster stage. But when born of a quadruped, we get to see a type of xenomorph called a runner. We see in the prequels that David took the original species that was developed by the engineers from a spore and modified them considerably, in essence, perfecting the xenomorph's lethality, adaptability, and defenses. As the kind of adaptability does not exist outside of viruses, to my knowledge, that has to be where they got this trait from.
It could be. I mean, they do get fairly inventive with the xenomorphs in this film, regardless of the issues that I have with it. There was also the dog xenomorph in this film as well, I believe. If it wasn't this one, it was Requiem. But it adds up that the xenomorphs aren't able to impregnate just about anything. I mean, even Jonesy the cat was a target for these things. They were probably built by the engineers and by David to have that kind of resilience.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. But I have to talk about a rather disturbing scene in the film. Rape is an ongoing theme in the Alien franchise. Granted, it's mostly in the form of facehuggers, but also with Ash when he attacked Ripley. However, in Alien 3, three prisoners attempt to rape Ripley quite literally.
That was a pretty ugly moment, I have to say, and I'm not sure it was needed. Granted, this is a prison film, and that's not an irrational prison fear. I also grant that these dudes probably haven't seen a woman in years. But I really didn't want a women in prison film in space, you know? That's taking the allegory too far, in my view.
Well, I did not like the scene either, and they could have gone without the scene. I do get it. I would imagine a woman locked in any male prison would likely have had that happen to them. At the same time, I don't see how it served the plot beyond showing us that our suspicions about that potentially happening were true. And you are right, it has been decades since they had seen a woman, but I just don't see how it advances the story.
It really doesn't at all. I mean, you could take the scene out and change just nothing substantial. But let's talk about scenes with a bit more impact, because there are some.
Sure thing, Steve. After being attacked by a xenomorph, Walter Gulick, a mass murderer and outcast among the prison population, becomes very disturbed after being assaulted by the alien and gradually becomes more and more obsessed with the creature, which he calls the Dragon. When he breaks out of the out of confinement and opens the door, trapping the xenomorph inside, there's a church-like music in the background, something akin to like the singing of monastic monks. Anyway, this has me wondering if there was not some this was not some kind of like a holy experience for him, like as if he believed he was on a mission from God. And I think that fits with the religion there at the prison.
That's very possible. I mean, it's interesting that you bring the church imagery. Some of the designs and sets that were used in this film were very cathedral-like. That actually came from a previous draft of the film that wasn't used, and they were recycled into the design of the prison. But I do think it works, as it's not uncommon for prisoners to find religion on the inside. As for Golic, I just want to add one thing as a Doctor Who fan. He was played by Paul McGann, who went on to play the Eighth Doctor in the TV movie and in the Night of the Doctor short, as well as the recent Power of the Doctor episode, as well as a ton of Big Finish Doctor Who audio dramas, which he's still doing to this day. I just love that you get both Time War Doctors in the Alien films between him and John Hurt. Anyway, I liked McGann in the role of Golic. I mean, he just comes across as unhinged, but oddly trying to be a better person than he was on the outside.
I think I found Golic particularly frightening because you get some religious fanaticism in a guy who is already mentally disturbed. Same people have done crazy things out of control things in the name of religion. And when you add mental instability to that, it just frightens me.
That makes total sense. I mean, faith can drive some people to extremes, even otherwise sane people, and Golic is way off from that.
I do have to say, though, that with all of its flaws, Alien 3 does give us one of the most iconic scenes in the franchise, with that runner getting all up close to Ripley's face to smell her while she turns her head in fear.
That scene is so creepy, and it's a screenshot that I see a lot in articles about the Alien series. The fact that the xenomorph runs off and leaves Ripley alone is a clear hint about how bad Sarah's situation is by that point.
I always thought it didn't kill her because it could smell the queen growing in her chest. And actually, speaking of that, in Alien Resurrection, the scientists are taking a queen out of the eighth Ripley clone, and I can't help but notice that Ripley is impregnated with a queen in Alien 3. Add to this a couple of Ripley's lines from Alien 3, which were, "You've been a part of my life for so long, I can't remember anything else." And even more revealing, Ripley refers to herself as part of the Xenomorph family in Alien 3. I wonder if there isn't a connection to needing Ripley's DNA to produce a queen, or if the queen embryo bonded with her DNA as well. I figure it has to be something like that. Otherwise, I don't understand the need for Ripley's DNA in Alien 3 or in Resurrection. Oh, and as a quick side note theory, what if Bert planted the egg on the EVE Sulaco before they ever got onto it? Kind of like a backup plan. Or do you have another theory about how the egg got on their EVE?
Not a good one. But then I don't think it was ever the original plan for Ripley to be impregnated during cryosleep. I'm not sure Burke would have had the opportunity to plant an egg on the Sulaco. But then the alien queen had a ridiculous ability to get around. And it's always possible that she planted an egg somewhere before that last big fight with Ripley. She was pretty intelligent and may have had a backup plan of her own. I also agree that the xenomorph left Ripley alone because it knew that Ripley was the host for its queen.
That's true. I hadn't considered that the queen could have done it, but she certainly could have, as she is that smart. It is unfortunate, though, that Alien 3 didn't give us a better answer. And speaking of things I wish Alien 3 had given us, I don't often complain about CGI in films as long as it works well enough to tell the story without taking me out of it. But the CGI in Alien 3 was terrible. They really should have stuck with the practical effects on in Alien 3 because those scenes were good. But the CGI in Alien 3 looks very fake, and it stands out from the rest of what's on the screen, which makes it bad enough that it's distracting.
The practical effects of the first two films are really hard to top, and it's true that this film doesn't reach that standard. CGI was a new technology at the time, and Fincher was probably inexperienced at working with it.
From what I understand, the issue was to lack of time to do it properly. As so the effects were rushed to meet the deadline that the studio put for the release. But we'll get into that later. So now is the part where we shift over into the making of and behind the scenes stuff. I think the best place to start has to be how they came up with the story. Gordon Carroll from Brandywine Productions talked about how they wanted to do something different with Alien 3. The only real ideas they had to start with was that they wanted to do to continue the duplicity of the company, aka Weyland-Yutani Corporation, and their need for the xenomorph for their bioweapons division, and they wanted a rich, ominous location for the film. Their first thought was to have it on a scientific way station where covert experiments would go on, but that fell through. However, you'll notice that's something Joss Whedon would pick up for Alien Resurrection. But their next idea was a sort of Alcatraz in space, and that idea, while it would get added to and played with a bit, is what we end up with in Alien 3. But whether or not that was going to be the case was not clear right away.
There were a number of different competing ideas of what Alien 3 might be, as I recall. There was a discussion of Hicks and Bishop going to the alien homeworld and going off to hunt bugs, but that idea fell through. I would rather have seen something like that than the movie we got, especially with the way all the alien supporting characters got fridged. The prison idea wasn't bad, to be fair. And in fact, it wasn't the inspiration for Pitch Black and the Riddick series. I just take the issue with the execution on certain things in Alien 3.
Honestly, the whole film was plagued with studio interference and indecisiveness. They talked to several people about directing Alien 3, including Ridley Scott, but they all turned it down for one reason or another. The first guy to accept was named Rennie Harlan. It did not work out with Harlan, but he had some great story ideas that would be used later. Harlan's first idea was to take the story back to where the xenomorphs come from and really explore what they are and perhaps even reveal that maybe they aren't innately evil creatures. Something akin to the idea is what we saw in Prometheus and was expounded upon in Alien Covenant. And here's an ironic tidbit. David Giler from Brandywine Productions said that he would love to have to do a Planet of the Aliens movie, but it was just too expensive to do at the time. And here's the ironic bit. He added that he would love to do that film someday, and he would love it if Ridley Scott would do it. But back to Alien 3. Harlan's next idea was to have the aliens come to Earth, and they even made a promo for it that was a play on the original ad for Alien, and it was, "On Earth, everyone can hear you scream." Going to Earth was a good idea and one that Joss would use in Alien Resurrections, but that ad campaign would have been terrible. Ultimately, though, the studio and Brandywine seemed to want to just rehash bits of the previous films, and that was something that he was just not interested in doing, so he walked away.
I think you hit on the problem with the entire process. I mean, Ridley Scott and James Cameron made great films because they both wanted to do something genuinely different. The studio just wanted to replicate what had worked before, and they seemed especially interested in going back to the tone of the first film. So Alien 3 ended up being a step backwards and probably would have been one regardless of who directed it.
I think you're right there. Rehashing is definitely something that had been avoided in the previous sequel and needed to continue to be applied to all of the sequels that followed. Plus, the studio put the cart before the horse by setting a release date before the film was even in production, and everything just kind of snowballed from there. The next guy to come on actually had a big effect on the story, and that was writer and temporary director Vincent Ward, who had done The Navigator, a Medieval Odyssey in 1988. Ward wrote the script for Alien 3 in about a month based on an idea he had for a wooden planet peopled by monks, and that seems to have been blended with Hill and Giler's Alcatraz in space idea into a prison planet peopled with criminals who have, in Ripley's words, found God on the ass end of space. I say this because that's basically what's in the film, and it is Ward, Giler, and Hill who are credited as the writers on the script. But here's the thing that really screwed up the film, and that was Fox. Fox was having financial trouble at the time, and we're talking about Alien 3 like it was supposed to save the company. Needing that payday is why 1 month after Ward finished the script, before things were even in production, Fox gave a release date of 1992 for the film. maybe the film could have been done well by then if Fox had stayed out of it. But not only did they not stay out of it, they constantly made changes to the staff, like bringing on and then letting go H.R. Giger without even, and then changing the script without even talking to the director. In fact, in some cases, it was deliberately behind his back, which doesn't make any sense to me. A house divided against itself cannot stand. For instance, when Ward found out about this stuff and complained about it, they just fired him and hired David Finch to replace him and make something out of the gutted Frankenstein of a script, which was constantly evolving as Walter Hill and David Giler kept making changes as the sets were developed.
Yeah, Frankenstein's script is just about right. I mean, the problem is that the Suits were taking too much creative control on themselves and leaving people like Fincher to fix the messes they caused. And Fincher didn't have nearly enough creative room to do that because of all the interference. There are a lot of different elements in the finished film that could work on their own, but because of the patchwork nature of the script, it all adds up into a jumbled mess of a film. Alien 3 is the weakest of the Ripley films to me, and it's partly because the tone and partly because the studio interference drags down a lot of promising ideas. I think Fincher did what he could with the mess that was handed to him, and I think it sucks that his career suffered for years over what was a studio failure and not a directorial failure.
Oh, we are totally agreed on that, my friend. But that wraps up part one of our Alien discussion, as well as part A of our fourth season's first episode. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about Alien Resurrection, Prometheus, and Alien Covenant. But before we go, I'd like to take this moment to thank our patrons who make this podcast possible. I hope you've enjoyed hanging out with us on ORP today. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to please share this episode and help us get the word out.
That is indeed a big help, and we want to thank you in advance for your support of both listening and sharing this episode. It means a lot to us, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.